and welcome to Beyond Busy, the show where we talk productivity, work-life balance and happiness. My name's Graham Alcott, I'm your host for the show, and on this episode I'm talking to Ben and Jodie Cook, co-founders of JC Social Media and a social enterprise called Clever Tykes. So it's been a pretty interesting couple of weeks in terms of the politics that's been going on and just the general madness in the UK and actually in lots of other parts of the world as well. It feels like there's just a lot of turbulence around at the moment. It's a pretty interesting time. I saw this on Twitter the other day. It said, if you're in a pub quiz in 20 years' time and the question starts, in what year? Just say 2016 and you'll be right. Which I thought was very apt, and is, I think I'll leave it there in terms of the politics and everything else. So, what I've been up to, a couple of weeks ago, I went to see my favourite band in the world, Hiatus Coyote. They played at Somerset House in London. I basically go to all of their gigs when they're in like London or Brighton or sort of somewhere near me. So it hasn't actually been that long since I saw them, but I realised I was the only person in the whole gig who had turned up there with some work to do. Like, I'd printed out this report that I'm working on, and it was like, okay, I'm just going to make some notes, just sat on the pavement for this outdoor gig, sort of watching the support band and drinking some wine, and then I'd also come from a 2-hour audit and risk committee meeting for Centrepoint, and it really kind of struck me, like, I feel like I'm the only person who has sort of had that experience of this gig. I think a lot of other people had obviously met friends and all that kind of thing, and I don't know if that makes me, if that gives me good work-life balance or bad work-life balance or what, I don't know. But it just kind of struck me that I was a bit of an outlier in that moment. A little heat wave happening here as well, which is great. I've got the entire Think Productive HQ team and partners coming to my newly refurbished and landscaped back garden for a barbecue on Friday. So I'm hoping the weather holds out. And it's meant my Asda orders have been really weird. Like, there's this £40 delivery limit thing, and I just breach it like all the time at the moment. And the guy turns up with just like boxes of ale and just ale and dishwasher tablets and nothing else. He must like, if he thinks that's what that guy eats and drinks or whatever, he probably thinks I'm crazy. And also just ordering a few different wines. So we've got this really nice wine cellar down the road from us called Butler's, and you can go in there and it's completely sort of unpretentious. They've got wines that are like £150 and stuff, but you can also just go in and say, hey, I want to spend £6 and I want red and I like this and whatever, and they'll just pick something that is amazing. So they really know their stuff. So I've taken it as a little excuse to buy like a range of different wines and then sort of taste them and then work out which ones to buy in bulk to make sure that, like, obviously it's got good wine for the barbecue on Friday. So that's been kind of fun. Nice excuse to drink more wine than I usually would, sat out in my garden in the sunshine. So what can be possibly bad about that? So on to Ben and Jodie Cook. So Jodie's the founder of a business that they both work for called JC Social Media, one of the leading social media agencies in the UK and the biggest in Birmingham. Ben also takes the lead on a social enterprise that they co-founded together called Clever Tykes, which you're going to hear about, which is all about inspiring the next generation of entrepreneurship. And, you know, just something I'm really passionate about. And I think they're doing something really fantastic there. He's also Jodie's trainer, because Jodie is a British powerlifting champion. And this was just a really fun and really wide ranging conversation. So we talked about goal setting, minimalism, a few bits of Zen in there as well. Really fun. And the first one interviewing a couple together, and there's something of a golden couple on the Birmingham business scene. So Jodie's the co-founder of the Birmingham Female Entrepreneurs Network. They've won some business awards and they've got this kind of real rising star reputation in Birmingham. So when I met Ben and Jodie, it was actually in London. They traveled down on the Chiltern line. So if you ever do the journey on the train from London to Birmingham and you go through Euston and New Street, I mean, New Street used to be like stressful and now it's like a cool place, but Euston's just a really stressful place to be. But the Chiltern line, it goes from Marylebone and then goes into Snow Hill, just much more relaxed, the whole thing. Legroom, Wi-Fi, like, it just generally quieter. Like, it's just a really nice way to travel. So they told me that they'd come down on the Chiltern line, which is obviously just like people after my own heart. And anyone who knows me knows that my nickname for Birmingham is the soul of the universe. So we started just talking about the underrated city of Birmingham.
It's got a lot going for it. There's new things opening there all the time. Well, for both of us, both of our families live there as well, so it's nice being really close to them. A lot of our friends live in London, and although I really like visiting, I just never fancied actually living in London.
Yeah.
So yeah, Brum's good. We live in the city centre, right by the Jewellery Quarter, and just walk everywhere, really. Yeah. The whole goal is to get the gym, home, work triangle to be as small as possible. And so our triangle is less than a mile.
Okay.
Which is perfect.
Cool.
So although we have a car, we just don't use it that much, apart from to go further. We don't really use it around Brum.
Ben, you're a fellow long-suffering Aston Villa fan.
Absolutely, yeah. That was absolutely a blow to the city. I think that Villa getting relegated this year.
It was a blow to half the city, probably.
I feel the Blues fans were happier about Villa going down than how sad the Villa fans were about going down. I think it's been a long time coming. But Albion are still doing it for the Midlands in the Premier League. We'll see. We'll see what happens. We won't talk for an hour about football, but yeah, absolutely, I care what Jody says. Birmingham is a fantastic place. There's so much going on. There's a lot of building work there. It's a thriving economy for startup businesses, particularly the tech scene as well. And Birmingham has had a bad rap in the past, and I think a lot of people imagine it as this place that it was in the 70s and 80s, but so much has changed, so much has been spent on the city, so much development, and I'd implore anyone who's not visited the city recently to get there and see it.
Yeah, and I saw it come up on one of those, like, you know, sort of BuzzFeed style, like, here are cool places to go and have a city break that you'd not thought of.
Mm.
And obviously, having spent a lot of time there, when I first saw that, I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then I was like, yeah, actually, like, if you've never been there, like, yeah, that's the perfect place to go for like a 3-day city break, right? Like, but I think a lot of people would just be like, what, Birmingham? That's kind of
definitely
an odd thing. And maybe because it's in the middle as well, like just that whole thing of just going to the middle for a break. You want to kind of go to the coast or on a plane or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, Birmingham's got other things to offer, hasn't it? Like the canal network. The new library is a stunning bit of architecture. And it is such a culture-driven city as well. So much to see. And also the food. We can't forget that. I mean, the 5 Michelin stars now.
Is it 5?
5,
okay.
Yeah. Wow. Carters have mostly picked up the 5th one for Birmingham, which is incredible, really, seeing as other cities in the UK, like Manchester, don't have any.
Yeah. I think it's none when I lived there, actually, which is only 10 years ago. I don't think there's a single Michelin star.
There's another restaurant in the Jewellery Quarter called Two Cats, which maybe might get the 6th one. So
they're certainly going for it, aren't they?
How do you get a Michelin star? Do you know? Like, how does
I don't actually know, but I think you have to be on the radar of the Michelin committee, and then I think the way you serve food and the things that are on your menu, I think have to be fairly formulaic, as in look at what other ones are doing, and tasting menus seem to go down pretty well.
So just having a tasting menu in that menu. But are you guys real foodies? Like,
not real foodies, and we hardly ever cook. Our kitchen's tiny. We have 2 hobs and an oven that's also a microwave, and just there's no space, and there's only space for 1 person in there. But
which we'll come on to. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, but we're all about the travel, train, and eat, and the eating is eating out and going to different Michelin star restaurants.
It's certainly an experience thing, isn't it? It's not just the food. You don't, you know, the price that you pay for some of these meals, it's not the price of the food, you know. It really is the experience, so you have to see it as a lot more than just the meal.
Absolutely. So I was really excited to get you guys on the podcast, and I want to talk to you about JC Social Media. So your business is now 5 years old, so we can talk about that, and also to talk to you about your books. And also just the fact that it was quite an interesting one for me, the idea of interesting you guys together, because you do everything together. You work together, you live together. And also you have a very set lifestyle that you're trying to lead, and like that you're both very conscious of designing that lifestyle. So I just thought it'd be cool to do one with a couple and do that together. And Jody, you said to me, Ben and I are 27, most of our friends... This is on an email. I'm going to quote your email back to you. Ben and I are 27. Most of our friends our age are doing the whole live in London thing, work yourself into the ground, then drink yourself to oblivion at weekends. And you said we couldn't be further from that.
Yeah.
So tell me about being far from that, and like what's the sort of consciousness in terms of setting up a lifestyle that's very the opposite of that or different to that?
Well, taking inspiration from lots of different authors and people who do it as well, I quite like Tim Ferriss's ideas around the new rich, and it's not the kind of old rich where it's just about having a big house, having a car, having all these different old rich type things. It's like all about how you craft your lifestyle. And so one of the things that Tim Ferriss talks about doing, and one of the things that we did maybe a couple of years ago, is wrote down on a piece of paper every day, every other day, every week, every month, and every year, and then next to each one write the things that you want to do every day, every other day, all cool. that thing. And then you start to realize that the things that you actually want to do all the time aren't really that far away, and you're probably doing a lot of them anyway. It's just like eliminating the ones you don't want to do and adding more in.
And were you thinking about that from a sort of point of view of, like, you know, a lot of people think about that, like, if I was rich I would do XYZ, and Tim Ferriss's idea of the new rich is don't wait to be a millionaire.
Yeah, just it's live actually like about, one, even if you're not.
Create the lifestyle that you want, and and actually flexibility and self-employment and some of those things can get you to that point much quicker.
Yeah.
So were you sort of looking at it in a very kind of idealised way? Is that how
sort
you...
Because the next stage in that process is assign a cost to everything. Mm. If you want to have Tim talks about salsa lessons and stuff. If you want to have a salsa lesson every month, how much is it going to cost you? And then add it all up and work out how much your year costs.
Yeah.
And it's probably a lot less than you think.
And then work out from there, this is optimally how much I need to earn to sort of pay for that lifestyle, which I think most people don't think of it that way around, do they? Most people just go, well, I'm on this salary, and so success looks like getting to this salary or getting a pay rise to this or whatever, right?
Yeah, I think, and then you run the risk of getting trapped in the rat race, I guess, where your salary goes up, your expenses go up, and then you're always in this constant state of always wanting to get to the next stage just so you can spend more.
Yeah.
So we thought of it a different way around. But then...
And what was on your list that you changed?
That we changed? I guess things like making time for going to really nice restaurants and making time to properly get into training and properly get into powerlifting. That's probably around the time I started competing as well, when we started talking about that.
Yep.
And eliminating things within work that maybe I did or Ben did that we were like, this isn't where our main skill set lies. We want to do different things.
I think it is streamlining your life to focus on the things that you do want to do. And it's very similar to what Jodie said. I think that rich has been defined by what you have. But now it is becoming what you do. And often a lot of the things you enjoy doing are free or don't cost very much. And of course, if you aspire to have a massive house and a certain style of car or even a yacht, the cost of that, like, you know, living is going to be into the millions. And you need a very well-paid job for that. You probably do need to live in London. But how many of us can sit down and say, actually, I'm doing exactly what I want to do right now. We're often too much living in the future or the past, and when we get there we will have all this. When we're a millionaire, millionaires, we will have all these things and do all these amazing things. And it's, you don't live in the future, you never live in the future, you're always living in the present. What can we be doing to make us happier in the here and now?
Yeah, that's dead right. And I think most of the people who aspire to own a yacht don't already love sailing. Right.
Yeah.
So it's more, what does owning a yacht mean and what's the status that brings, rather than like, oh, my passion is sailing. And
absolutely. Yeah.
So I think you're dead right. It's like, you know, trying to figure out, you know, make the starting point. What do I want to do every day or every 2 days? I love that thing of like every day, every 2 days, every week, every month, every year. Did you make a list of the things you didn't want to do every day, or the things that you wanted to make sure we're not going to be on that list? Do you know what I mean? Like, what's the sort of opposite list?
We did the drill where there's, what are the things that you want to start doing?
Are
the things you want to stop doing? What are the things you want to do more often? What are the things you want to do less often? And of course, there probably were things that came up then, although that was a while back now, so I think we'd do well to pick some of those out. Ending up in supermarkets, spending hours in supermarkets. Probably
I hate supermarkets. That was when we started doing, well, first we started just doing online Tesco shops and then getting them every week and having that thing where it just does it for you automatically. And then you click, that's what I want. And then we don't spend that much time in supermarkets now.
No, we're fairly efficient with that.
I don't spend much time in shops. Dislike shops.
I
mean, the last thing I bought in a shop was, I went into the shop to buy those Bose headphones, the ones that are like noise reduction, because it's one of those things that I have to test them out and see if they're actually any good. And I walked out going, shit, they're amazing. I just bought them on the spot. But apart from that, it's always online for me.
Yeah,
definitely.
But then even shopping, you don't have to do it at the weekend, like your, the difference between your experience of going on a Saturday morning when the shops are rammed and going on a Monday afternoon just because you can.
Yeah,
you'll even have a completely different experience doing that. So it's like stepping away. Rob Geraghty calls it like the millionaire life, the millionaire experience. Sorry, about doing things not when everyone else does them.
And so, and then, you know, and everything's like that. So the train is a much nicer experience if you don't do it at peak times, and, you know, just all those things if you don't follow the crowd, which I guess to be able to not follow the crowd, you have to have a sense of autonomy, and self-employment is a big part of that for you guys as well. So Jodie, just tell us about the start of your business, JC Social Media. Like, where did that, how did that come about, and what was your journey into that?
5 years ago, I was 22, and I didn't start it to start a business, to start a lifestyle, to kind of do all the things we did now. I basically started it because I wanted to do social media for different companies, and because I wanted to create myself a job. That was my only thinking at the time. And then I somehow managed to get myself a website, managed to get myself kind of set up, and started telling people about what I was doing. A friend who I was on a graduate scheme with told her employer what I was doing, and then she said, "Oh right, okay, my boss wants to meet you to talk about some work that you could do for us." I was like, "Oh, okay." So, and that was in Blackpool, so I went all the way up the M6 and didn't go with any kind of any experience, obviously, because I hadn't really done much stuff before apart from my graduate scheme. But I just went with so many ideas, so much passion about, like, yes, this is what I can do, that I just kind of exploded that all in the conversation. And then he just kind of went, "Oh yeah, okay, then. All right, go for it." And then I found that once you have one client, the second feels a lot easier, so does the third, and then just built up to a full-time job running the social media for all different weird and wonderful clients, and then started to hire people.
So at the start, you were the only employee?
Yes.
And you were basically doing the sort of frontline social media for different clients. How many at one time? Like, how many different clients are you working?
I can't remember how many clients I had at the start, but I got up to about 35 hours a week of client work after about 7 or 8 months. And then that's when I had a decision that I could either do that forever, just be freelance, as loads of people do, or I could start hiring. And that's when I decided I want to start growing a team.
And tell me where you are now. So you're now 5 years in. Just paint a picture of what the business looks like now.
12 people. Global clients, local clients, 5 ebooks, loads and loads of cool stuff going on.
Cool.
A few awards as well.
A few awards, yeah.
Yeah, you guys are really annoying. Like, award-winning, good-looking, entrepreneurial, kind of, you're both, like, just very successful in, like, everything you put your minds to.
Thank you.
I feel like they all work together fairly well.
Yeah,
I think so. And we spend a lot of time, you know, on this the kind of self-improvement, self-development thing. And I think that it's all interlinked, isn't it? You become a better communicator, a better manager. You know, we spend quite a lot of time in the gym, become a better athlete. It does tie in with each other.
Yeah, and one thing I didn't mention there, Jodie, is you're the British champion for powerlifting.
Oh yeah. I started competing at powerlifting last September, and then after just nothing really, apart from realizing I was pretty good at it,
was that just like you were in the gym and you were lifting weights in the gym? Was it a simple
started thing? Off lifting weights in the gym, and then a couple of years ago Ben got qualified as a strength and conditioning coach with UKSCA, and then started training me. And then I started getting better. And then first started competing, qualified for nationals last year, won the British Championships at the 55.5 kilo weight category. And now I'm competing with a new federation. So I've got nationals in September now.
Wow. And so Ben was training you. So that leads me on to a question, which is like, in your relationship and in your work, who's the boss?
It's a good question, actually.
I don't really know.
Yeah, I think we very much work together on things, and I think that's one of the biggest things that people say to you about working together. So we work together, we're in the office a lot, we go to some meetings together, we're in the gym a lot, and obviously we live together in quite a small flat, so we do spend a lot of time with each other.
Who's the boss?
I think the main thing is that you work together as a team, and you share the same values, and I think therefore you can kind of slip in and out of who's in charge on something because it fits your skill set, or if someone's got a good idea about something.
Mm. Is it like one of you takes that role on, you know, certain things and one on the other, or is it everything's like is everything a very joint decision? Or
I think sometimes if it's in one of our areas of expertise, then that person can take the lead and the other one can play a supporting role. I mean, in the gym, it's a very much, from my point of view, I'm coaching and Jodie is the athlete, but we try as best as possible to find the best solution, and usually if we talk that out and come to a decision together, it's generally the best.
Because we have been together for 9 years, so since we were 18, so we probably started off in very different places, but then just kind of worked out our values together, because you change so much between 18 and 27 as well, so it's just quite good that we've been able to grow together rather than grow apart.
And in terms of the sort of developing a lifestyle and sort of thinking about that side of things, and sort of perhaps like even with the business, do you feel like one of you was more the driving force around that, or like did you both come into it at the same time? Like, was one of you kind of more influencing the other? Like, how did that come about?
Well, I started Jay Social Media and you were at uni doing various bits, modelling and personal training, things like that.
Yeah, that's the first thing after I went out. The first thing I did after graduating was do my personal training diploma. So I did an economics degree, really enjoyed it, but I thought I don't want to go straight into a 9-to-5. So there's always been an element between the two of us that we didn't necessarily want to go into a straight 9-to-5. And I'd spent a couple of years doing some modelling work whilst Jodie was setting up JC Social Media. And I think I did a job where I worked with a guy who was well into his 70s, and I just saw this was my future. I was going to be doing modelling work, going down to London for castings, which are the model auditions, and I'd be doing this forever. And it's self-employment, so there's no real security. And I could see Jodie was progressing in her business and starting to employ people, and thinking actually we're going to have a lot more control if we go on the business side of things, as opposed to being at the beck and call of companies who need people to show off their products or services. So that was probably the catalyst for going into that, and Jodie was starting to read a lot more about lifestyle design and certain books on how to make business work for you in your lifestyle, and it just made sense for me to start getting involved on that side. And so I started doing a bit of work for Jay's Social Media when that that enabled us to probably to grow it faster. And then the idea for Clever Types arose, so that's probably how I got more integrated into the business side of things.
So let's talk about Clever Types, which I love those books. I remember meeting you, Ben, and having lunch and taking those books home and reading them on the train back. And so just tell me about those books and the sort of the birth of that, like where did the idea come from for Clever Types?
Sure, yeah, well it came from Jodie's business, really. Jodie's probably better at the story. Yeah. So I'll hand over at the moment.
It was around a year into JC Social Media, and through a friend called Carrie Green, who owns the Female Entrepreneur Association, I got invited to be an ambassador of startup loans, because at the time they were first starting out. They were offering loans and support and mentorship and things to 18 to 24 year olds at the time, and they wanted examples of people who had started their business on less than £1,000. So it was me, it was my friend Carrie, and 10 other young, like all under 30 business people who'd all started their business on less than £1,000, including people like James Eder of Student Beans and all these huge companies. And at the time, I think I had one member of staff, and I was feeling a bit out of my depth. What the hell am I doing here, type thing? But it was great. And so the meeting was chaired by James Kahn of Dragon's Den, and he went round. It felt a bit like Dragon's Den, actually, because he went round and he asked everyone about their business, about turnover, about goals and stuff like that. And then he got to the end, and this was after hearing everyone's amazing stories about what they'd achieved so far and what they had planned. And James Kahn said, out of interest, out of the 12 of you, who has a parent that's also started their own business? And so I put my hand up, because my mum's been self-employed for 15 years or so, and I thought there might be a few of us, but it was 11 out of the 12 people within the room who had also had a parent who'd started their own business. And so it was quite a powerful moment, because we all, with our hands raised, just kind of looked at each other going, that's when we thought there's definitely something in this. And so we came up from London, talked to Ben about it, and we started doing a bit of research around it. And then we spoke to Professor Francis Green at the University of Birmingham, because he had written a paper called Like Mother, Like Daughter, Analyzing Maternal Influences on Entrepreneurship, which basically found that they're so inherently linked if you grow up with an entrepreneurial parent, because they're a role model to you, it helps you develop certain skills and characteristics.
Is that different between men and women? So could it have been like father, like son, or was he making a particular point about the maternal influence being bigger than the paternal influence?
Professor Green, definitely his paper was between, you know, daughters and mothers, but there's been quite a few studies that show there's the main driver is that there is a role model in the family, whether it's a father or a mother.
Right.
That seems to be the key driver, and there's a lot of studies on this that show it, and it's something like 80%. In some studies, have shown people are 80% more likely to start their own business if they grow up with an entrepreneur in the family. And this is where, you know, Jodie and I were thinking, hang on, we've got to do something about this. We know there's this link; it's really evidenced. And of course, if you flip it on its head, if a child grows up without an entrepreneurial parent, they're up to 80% less likely to start their own business. And of course, there's this real link between unemployment as well. If a child has an unemployed parent, they're much more likely to grow up and be unemployed. And we thought, well, how are these children getting their enterprising role models? And by enterprising, we mean the kind of innovative, resourceful, independent, and above all, probably positive role models. And we thought, well, they don't have them. Let's see what we can find in storybooks. And we started having a look at through storybooks and the role models children have outside their parents and the ones they have at school. And we could find loads of role models in traditional jobs. So there's the postman Pats, Fireman Sam, Bob the Builder types.
Yeah.
Very traditional roles. Obviously, kids know about what doctors, dentists, nurses do. They have a lot of interaction with characters like shopkeepers, so they're familiar with these kind of roles. And the old adage is a child can only aspire to what it knows exists. So we thought, fantastic, there's some great role models here in these traditional jobs, but what about business people? So we started having a look round, and we couldn't really find any. In fact, there were more negative role models. So Mr. Burns from The Simpsons.
Yeah, Mr. Burns from The Simpsons is the first
one. He's horrible.
That's right to my mind as well. Right? So like, that's such a negative.
Typical, the sneaky, conniving, greedy boss of a nuclear power plant.
And then Lord Business from the Lego movie.
Yeah, Lord Business from the Lego movie.
Evil antagonist. He glues all the Lego together so that no one can play with it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's.
And I thought you were going to say Lord Sugar. I mean, seriously, for kids, I mean, you watch The Apprentice and you think that sort of. I mean, his portrayal, which is, it's kind of grumpy and angry and whatever. But a lot of the stuff on his portrayal of entrepreneurship is like, you know, that role, the little scene where the Rolls Royce kind of.
Yeah, like,
absolutely.
All that stuff is just very sort of inauthentic to what the experience is for most people running businesses. Right?
Yeah, and you have to hand it to shows like The Dragon's Den and The Apprentice that they have brought entrepreneurship and business to the fore of a lot of people's minds. But the way it's been done has been in a very traditional, you know, business people are cutthroat and ruthless and it's all about the money.
Yeah.
And it's touching on the new rich idea, but most people these days aren't starting a business to make millions or even billions of pounds. They're starting it to create a lifestyle. And there's a very mixed opinion about how good influence is The Apprentice and Dragon's Den on young people. So you're absolutely right. There are a lot of negative role models. And we thought, well, if we want children to grow up through their school lives, basically being told, get some good grades, get to university, land yourself a great career job. If we're telling people all this and then we're spending loads of money in schemes like Startup Britain, Startup Loans, and saying, well, actually, you've graduated now. Even though we've been telling you all this time you should get a career job, there is another way, you should be a businessman. These children have grown up with such negative role models. I don't really think that's something people aspire to. And we
imagine saying to a child, hey, do you want to start a business? And they go, oh, business people, overweight, sweaty, pinstrap suits, like horrible, horrible people. Why would I ever want to do that? And that's a massive problem.
And the analogy we kind of liken it to is sport, and there are some exceptions to this, of course, but if we wanted more rugby players in our society, we wouldn't approach 21-year-old footballers who had been playing football their whole lives and said, oh, by the way, here's a rugby ball, here's a manual on how to play rugby, go and be the next Johnny Wilkinson. they take a grassroots approach, and we start playing tag rugby with kids as young as 6 or 7. That's when children are most receptive to new ideas, new skills, and learn our quickest. And that's exactly the approach we took with Clever Tights. We thought we need to give children the ideas, the skills, the attitude whilst they're in their formative years, and hence we decided to create a series of storybooks aimed at 6 to 10 year olds.
So you've got, is it three books?
Three books, absolutely, yeah, that's right, yeah.
You've got characters like Cody the Coder.
Yeah, we've got Walk It Willow, who decides to walk dogs for her neighbours. We've got Code It's Cody, who's really interested in computers, but the computer technician at school decides, you know, you've got a real talent, you should actually learn how to code. And then Change It Cho, who's a feisty social entrepreneur who champions healthy eating and ultimately sets up a fruit stall in her village. So there's a number of traits and a number of different skills that are promoted through the stories. And, you know, we've had some fantastic feedback from kids, from parents, and they've been used in over 100 primary schools across the country, and we've just delivered just under 2,000 books to one of the UK's leading education suppliers. So we know that these books are going to be in the hands of thousands of kids, and they're going to be gaining those role models that some may already have, but some of them won't.
Yeah, and you self-published?
Yeah, we certainly did.
We worked out, well, so we're both fairly impatient people. And so we worked out that the publishing process with books is so long. Just so long. So yes, you'll send your manuscripts off. Well, you'll know. They come back, and then 3 months later they say, hey, yeah, we might like it. Let us know. Like, send us a new copy, and then we'll tell you in 6 months. And it was just all like, hang on, we're going to be like in our 60s before these books are published. So we decided that we approached a company who helped to get books and different products into stockists after a recommendation from someone else. And they had a look at the product. They just said, yeah, we can get these into stockists. That's what we can do. So we thought, okay, well, let's do it. Let's self-publish. Let's speak to these guys and let's try and avoid the publisher altogether.
Yeah.
So we've been working with that company a while. They got us into Harrods and Selfridges and Waterstones online, and a few more. So it's great. And no one's ever said anything about not being published with a publisher.
Yeah, and I think for me, I mean, my journey with Productivity Ninja was, it was originally self-published, and then I found a publisher that could get me into WH Smith's and those kind of places. But that was really one of the main reasons I went with the publisher at that point, was distribution. So to get that distribution and to have it, you know, in Harrods and in all these different places, I just think to be able to do that and be self-published is fantastic. So
yeah,
you guys have done really well with that.
No, thank you. Yeah, no, because it was a very big decision at the time. As you'll know, there's so many pros and cons, and you really have to weigh it up. I think one of the main benefits is that we were already in a kind of marketing space, and so that we knew that we'd be able to market it. And a few people said, well, the publishers will get it out, this the distribution, but not necessarily the marketing. You might have to do some of the marketing yourself. Yeah. And we thought, let's go for it. Let's do it and see where it goes. And that's, you know, so far it's definitely been the right decision for us.
And you're waiting on a phone call, an email at the moment?
Well, so the goal for Clever Tykes is a big goal. It's to break the cycle of unemployment, and especially of generational unemployment. So how we want to do that in the UK, because we're aware that the kids whose parents can afford to shop at Harrods and Selfridges are not necessarily the ones that will benefit the most from the books. We want to reach the kids who have never been in Harrods and Selfridges. We decided that we wanted to get sponsorship to put the books and the resources in all of the 20,000-odd primary schools in the whole of the UK. So yeah, we're in fairly good stages, good talks with a couple of people. So yeah, watch this space.
So you've got a sponsor that's going to help you to do that potentially, and it's just like, see what comes back, see yes or no.
That's it.
Yeah.
We're looking for a socially responsible company who's aligned with generating, you know, this generation of positively minded people with this skill set that this country definitely needs.
And
as Jodie said, we've had some good discussions, but we're doing both a physical rollout of the books but also a digital one, so that we know that a lot of teaching resources are digitally led these days. So there's lots to it, and it will be really, really exciting for us if that comes off.
And I guess the fact that you remained self-published through that, this getting into author and book talk here, but I think the benefit of then being able to really dictate the terms of that sponsorship, because you still have control over books, is a great place to be.
Absolutely. And,
you know, that's maybe one of the reasons why, like, you know, if you've got that sort of wider social purpose with a book,
having more control is better than what the distribution of a publisher might bring you, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we knew that with the books, there hasn't been anything like this before. And it is that kind of edutainment type genre, which is bigger in the States. And that's obviously a word that has come over from the States. But it's never really taken off too much here. One of the great examples is Horrible Histories, teaches children about history in a very entertaining way. But we knew that if we did go with a publisher, there were a number of things that they might want to tinker with. And actually, the messages in the books are quite subtle, but we very much had our own ideas how that we wanted that to come across. So keeping control was very much an important thing for us. And like you said, that now later down the line, and we're looking at these kind of projects, it's hopefully going to pay dividends. Mm.
And what I mean, I just think it's a fantastic project, and yeah, just well done on where you've got it to so far. What I love about those three characters as well is that none of them are setting out to set up a huge business empire.
Yeah.
And the dog walking thing really reminds me of my first business when I was about 12 or whatever, which was going around mowing lawns. You know, it's just like going around and washing cars and mowing lawns and just stuff around my local neighbourhood. Where I'd figured, hey, I can go and make a few quid here and get my pocket money together that way,
and that's exactly
that sort of thing, right? So it's like introducing it on a very accessible sort of level, rather than like let's set out for world domination from day one. And because a lot of people think that's how business is, right? That have entrepreneurs have these like massive, hairy, audacious goals that are just so off the scale from day one and that sort of thing, right? But just making it very accessible and small and local and achievable.
Absolutely.
A lot of the kids that have read the books now, some of the reviews that we've got have been, like you said, along those lines of starting small, but starting really. And so there's a girl called Hannah who read all three books, and then her dad went to see her and she'd written a list of chores that she could do around the house and assigned monetary values to them from 2p to 20p.
That's amazing.
And so she started hoovering the living room.
What did you get 2p
like
for?
I think it was just putting one item away or something like that. And then there's a guy called Fraser who's the son of a friend who he decided that he was going to start a car washing business, and he said to his dad, can I wash mom's car? And he said okay, and he said, can I have a fiver for it? And he went, oh yeah, go on then, I'll give you the fiver after you've done it. And apparently he didn't wash it very well, so he only got £3. But apparently that's the harsh reality of business.
Those things, so when I did car washing, and I still remember this to this day, I did it with a friend of mine called Stuart Webster, who I recently got reacquainted with on LinkedIn after about like 15 years or something. But yeah, like we went round the estate and we were washing cars, and we washed this bloke's car, and there was two of us doing it together. And I said to Stuart, thinking like, let's, I'm like 11 or 12 at the time, whatever. And I was like, let's see how successful we can make this business. And obviously to make it more successful, we have to wash the cars quicker. So we're like, let's see how quickly we can wash this car. So we washed this car really quick, and we thought we'd done an amazing thing of washing the car. Ringing the bloke's doorbell 5 minutes later after we'd started, and he came out, and basically he was reluctant to pay us because we'd done it too fast.
Oh.
And car was clean, right? But he didn't like the fact that he didn't get. He wanted us to sweat for our money.
Right? Okay.
So that was a very important business lesson around sort of customer service and perception. And
yeah,
it's amazing what you can learn from these the sort of formative.
So you should have maybe washed the first car, washed the second and third, and then gone back to the first.
And then gone back to clear the money. Yeah, we'll do it in a different way.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely right. And the reality of it is important, because so often we do just hear the headlines, don't we? This child entrepreneur has made £10 million. And I don't necessarily think putting those stories in front of kids is really what they want to know, because when children, they don't know the value of £10 million. And it always seems so unachievable.
And also, I think sometimes, with... who's the guy who did really well on YouTube? 3 or 4 years ago, SBTV, that guy? And so he's made millions and millions, but basically there's only going to be one of him in that genre. And so if you're trying to emulate that as someone who's really into grind music or whatever, it's like, well, that's kind of been done, So trying to find your own niche is more difficult, whereas anyone can go and wash some cars or pick up a lawnmower or whatever, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose that idea of entrepreneurship being small, practical, accessible,
Jodie, you were saying when you set up your business, it was like to give me a job. It was, you know, to sort of start that process of not to give me a job, to give me a job. But like, so you'd started it with that sort of small intention of like giving yourself a job, not with an intention of like scaling up. And then later you decided to scale up. Where are you at with that now in terms of, like, would you love to have like a 200 person digital agency, or would that feel like
bring it on?
but would that feel like stress, in the sense of, you know, like part of it is about having a business that gives you a really positive lifestyle, and having the stress of 200 people might be more negative than having an agency of 20 people. So like, where are you at with that sort of ambition?
Well, I think I'm glad that I started doing everything, and as I've hired more people, I've gradually empowered the people that work for me to do those things as well. So something we did a couple of years ago was created a manual for running JC social media. So every question that I was asked, I wrote down the answer. I obviously gave that person the answer, then I wrote down the answer, and then the next time anyone asked me, it was right, it's in the manual. And then gradually over, well, it was a couple of months actually, putting everything all in, we've got a sheet for how to do absolutely every single process. So it means that now, so we've got a general manager who, she's brilliant, she looks after making sure clients are happy, making sure the team is happy, and anything that she doesn't know, she'll look in the manual and then gradually learn it from there. So I mean, we've set it up pretty well, so I don't think 200 people would be a massive stress. It'd just be great, as long as we had all the right bums on the right seats then.
Yeah, and you could scale that manual then, presumably, in terms of the manual just has more stuff in it, and you have, the teams are bigger and everything else, but and you don't feel like that would drag you back in too much.
No, I think it'd be fine, and I'm still learning how people are best motivated and how clients are best kept happy. But as long as we do just focus on clients and team, then I can see us getting to that size. I think it's probably one of the goals as well. We've definitely got the biggest social media agency in Birmingham, probably about the third or fourth in the country. So yeah, it'd be great to get to that size, just because it means that you're doing a good job for clients.
Yeah, and are there like sort of businesses that you emulate, either in your space or just other businesses that you sort of follow, that you think, oh, I'd love to get to that size or be more like them? Or
there's quite a few, probably the more tech-based companies and their culture and ethos. I like the Netflix theory, that they don't really have guides on, like they don't have employee handbooks or anything. It's just do what's right for Netflix.
Okay.
And so they won't have a set number of holiday days or anything. It's just do what's right for Netflix. Yeah. And I think that's really cool. And I think as long as you have got the right people who have the right ethos, which is like, that's the hiring decision, isn't it, that gets that right, then that could be really good. So yeah, a few like that.
Interesting. And tell me about something else you talked to me about on email, is the philosophy of being a tree.
Being a tree is about not internalizing problems and not internalizing other people's mood swings and things that happen. So it could be any given day, you could pick up your emails and you get this email from someone who's really stressed out, and if you wanted to straight away, you could be like, oh, okay, I need to sort this out, I'm really stressed out too, I need to do everything. But what I try and practice, and what I teach my team to practice, is not being reactive to things like that, about kind of saying, right, okay, have I done everything I needed to, what can I do now, and kind of being this tree that isn't sort of just swayed by anything and everything. Because I think being an entrepreneur, it can feel like you're always on an emotional roller coaster, because things aren't just a little success. Things are, wow, this is the best thing ever, I've got the best business ever. And then things aren't just a little blip. It's like, oh, this is the worst day ever. And so if you don't control that, you end up being on this constant emotional roller coaster of up and down. And that's why I think entrepreneurship is quite linked to things like depression and bipolar, because you are up and down all the time. So I spend quite a lot of time focusing on maintaining that kind of chilled out, it's okay if someone throws a ball at me, I don't have to catch it kind of state.
So being a tree is it's a sort of Zen thing in some ways. It's about being grounded, not being swayed too much.
I think so.
Like being quite steadfast in kind of like, here's what I can do in these situations, rather than sort of, you know, moulding yourself to the reaction of what's going on, right?
Yeah. I think it's a lot to do with control as well, that in any given situation, someone could say pretty much anything to me, and my first response would be, right, okay, and then I'm going to think about it for a bit, and then it's going to be my response rather than just a reaction, because you lose control as soon as you give a reaction.
And did you learn that, or was that, have you always been like that?
I probably haven't been. I think Ben's probably helped me about it with it quite a lot, especially when I was running a business and you were doing other things, and you probably noticed that I was kind of up and down. It was never like a stable thing, so I learned it from.
And so at that point, you would come home from, like, the early stages of a business is always a busy time. You'd come home from busy long days and be, if you're anything like my wife, it's like the first thing you do is sort of download. Is that like, yeah, is that a reality? So, and then it's your job in that sort of phase of it was to almost like be the sounding board and the coach and the...
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And I very much noticed it on Jodie, but Jodie's always been a little bit up and down, a bit flitty. but, and I've always tried to be more steadfast. And I think I've always been able to take emotion out of some of the business side of things, and I think that's really, really important, because humans are very irrational, and we're irrational because we're emotional. Mm. And it leads to people making the wrong decisions, and there's a lot to do with, you know, you think a situation is a certain way, when in reality it's not that way. Yeah. And you can only make decisions when you've got all the information available, things like that, and getting emotional, getting down and getting up doesn't help make the best decisions. So you're always best off to be pretty cool, calm and collected, and it's hard. I think you do have to practice it. And
but it's sort of about coming out of your own head as well, because you could read some email from someone, and so this is, I've done this with various different people when they've gone, oh, that email was really rude, and it's like, well, is that something that's true, or do you just think it's true? Could it, is it actually a rude email? How is it a rude email? Have they sworn at you? Have they insulted your family? Like, oh no, they've just you know, put a full stop and written kind regards. Like, it's nothing really. It's actually, no, this is okay, this situation is fine. It's in your head, and if you can take it out of your head, then your reality is just a lot happier, I think.
Yeah, your comment about email, you know, full stop, kind regards, just reminded me of, you know, that Twitter feed is called Very British Problems.
Yes, yes.
And it's like the difference of realities between someone's in the queue and, no, everything's fine, but they're fuming. it's like that's the most British thing ever.
Yeah, there's a lot of very British things like that. But it's just all ridiculous, isn't it?
Okay, so back to Ben and Jodie in a few moments. There's no sponsored content bit on this episode, but I just wanted to share a couple of things with you. So a couple of things I just wanted to get out into the world and help to promote. So the first is a little productivity tip. I had a Skype call booked with Mohammed Faris a couple of days ago. He is the founder of a thing called Productive Muslim. Those of you who've followed me for a while, I know that I did some fasting for Ramadan a couple of years ago as part of my year of extreme productivity experiments. You can find all that just through Google. And Mohammed, that was kind of his idea that we did that. And he really helped me through that whole sort of process of it. And I really loved the experience of just getting really innately curious about a completely different culture. And, you know, and just learning something completely different around productivity as a result of that. So that was a really fun experience, and we've kept in touch, and we just Skype every now and again. We haven't spoke for a while, but we tend to just Skype every few months. So we're on Skype, and Skype's doing what Skype always does, which is it goes glitchy, and then, you know, most of your conversation ends up being about Skype and whether it's working and all the rest of it. So really frustrating, like 15 minutes of that. And then Mohammed suggested we switch to a thing called Zoom. So it's just zoom.us. And we were in the same Wi-Fi connectivity. So Mohammed was in Saudi, I was here in Brighton, and exactly the same Wi-Fi setup. And it went from being this horrible glitchy Skype experience to Zoom being like HD camera, crystal clear conversation. And it just made a huge, huge difference. And it made me think, wow, like, why is Skype still so glitchy? And also, why is it still like the default thing? It's become like Google or Hoover in that sense, is that you use it as the verb, right? It's like, I'm going to Skype someone. But I think, you know, I've never really been into the Google Hangouts thing. Like, you know, I'm not a massive, like, not a massive Gmail or Google kind of world user, although now that I'm Android and not iPhone, I'm kind of going that way. But yeah, zoom.us, it's I think it's $14 a month for the subscription, and you only need one of you to do it. So Mohammed was already a subscriber, I didn't need to pay to get onto it. But crystal clear, like, really, really good service. And yeah, Mohammed was really raving about it. So I'm going to be checking that out over the next few weeks. I realised when I say that, some of you will have been using that for like years and be like, well, yeah, obviously. Like others of you are frantically writing that down, so it's just zoom.us. Also, just wanted to share a book with you. So in the last few days, I've been reading this amazing book. It's called An Optimist's Tour of the Future. And it's by a guy called Mark Stevenson. And it's actually been on my shelf for about a year and I just hadn't got around to it. And I picked it up recently thinking I could really do with a dose of optimism right now and to sort of think about the future in some different ways. And man, it's an incredible read. It's really funny. And it's like, you know, every five pages, just there's something that just blows your mind. It's really, really interesting. But yeah, I mean, just the idea is to sort of take a step back from all of this stuff like Brexit and terrorism and all this awful stuff that's happening everywhere. And just go, there is a bigger and better future for us as humans. And, you know, we get to shape that. And the technology is developing and emerging, and a lot of it already exists, you know, but we can bring about, you know, massive changes in medical care and actually in human longevity. Stuff to do with 3D printing is going to completely democratize how we think about, you know, certain resources. How energy is going to change is really going to change the whole kind of political and economic map and really make us think, you know, ironically, given what this podcast is about, much more deeply around what is a good life and what does work-life balance really mean, and do we even need to work, right? So I think there's the potential to get to that kind of a level with this stuff. So really, really good book. It's called An Optimist Tour of the Future. It's by Mark Stevenson. And it is out everywhere on Amazon and, you know, all those other places. But yeah, really recommend it, particularly if you're kind of down about what's going on in the world right now and you want to just kind of think about how the future could be better. Really, really good book. So let's get back to Ben and Jody. And we were talking, I mean, there's a little bit of conversation about minimalism before, but we're talking about the fact that they live in a deliberately very small house and they have this real kind of interest in minimalism. So we're going to pick up the conversation here with Ben, just talking about their stuff.
So one of the things we started realising we didn't have very much stuff was, so last year, 2015, we lived in, I think, in 12 different places. And when you have to move 11 times, you realise how much stuff you actually have and how much of it you definitely don't need.
And was this an intentional thing to live in 12 different places? Or?
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah, it kind of happened by accident. But we were going to... So we went to live in Sydney for January. And there was something about renting a house in Birmingham that we weren't going to live into for a whole month that really got to me. And I was like, I'm not paying rent in a house that I'm not living in. So we took the decision to move out of the house. And so we had to live somewhere before we went to Sydney. Whilst we were in Sydney, we had to put our stuff in storage. So that was a bit of a blow.
Because five foot by five foot storage unit.
Yeah, so we were actually having to buy storage, which was a bit of a reality check because we wanted to leave some in a car or whatever. But when you get everything out of your flat and put it in a room and you see everything, you really start to think, you realise how much rubbish you have.
Yeah.
Mm. And so kind of halfway through the year, we realised that we got to be able to fit everything in our car, which was incredibly liberating. And some people might not, I mean, our cars, we don't have a massive car. This no. is a Citroën DS3.
Does this include the two front seats? Like, can you still drive it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Plus possessions
in the car.
It might be a bit sketchy at times getting on the motorway with the amount of stuff we had in it, but it did fit in the car. And some people might not realise that what a challenge that is, but I can guarantee most people would take a number of cars, if not a removal lorry, to fit all their stuff in it.
Yeah.
And so that was so liberating to have anything in your car. You can be anywhere and you know that you could pack up everything in your car in an hour and just leave and go somewhere else. And that was a really great feeling. And so I guess it started from there. We started getting rid of our stuff that we didn't need. And I know Jodie will probably explain a little bit the difference between minimalism and essentialism. And it was very much, what are the essentials? Get down to that. And that probably is where it started.
So what is the difference then, minimalism and essentialism?
Well, I don't know if there's a widely known definition, but I don't really like the term minimalism because I think you're not defined by what you don't do. So, like, I don't drink alcohol, but I don't define myself as a teetotaler because I'm not defined by something, by the absence of something.
Yeah.
So the, and it's like a maybe atheist, because you're, it's like defining yourself by the absence of a religion. So I'm not too sure about those terms. So I quite like the term essentialist, because what it means is you just focus on the absolutely necessary and eliminate everything else. So that's the kind of term I go by. And there's a book, I think there's a book called Essentialism in Practice. But it's kind of going back to the Tim Ferriss, what do you want to do every day, every week, every month, every year, and what are the possessions that you need in order to have that lifestyle.
And it was a big part, it sounds like a big part of that for you with, you know, moving to Sydney, you've been in Toronto, you've moved around different cities, and you can kind of take your laptops and carry on working on the business, but from different parts of the world. So it sounds like a big part of that essentialism was the ability to be nimble and to be able to move quickly and move around. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I think, I don't know about you, but it sort of scares me, the idea of having a 3-bedroom house with a garden and all the kind of grown-up stuff that comes with it. Like I really like being able to kind of just get up, pack your bag, and you've got your laptop and everything you need, because you don't actually need that much stuff.
Yeah.
And having too much stuff and having things just in case, it's all sort of a symbol of fear. It's like, yeah, I need an extra t-shirt just in case this is going to happen. I need an extra something just in case this is going to happen. But really, you actually don't need anything. If you're going on holiday, so we went and did some remote working in Dubai for a month and did some work out there as well. And all you actually need is your passport.
Yeah.
And the clothes you're wearing. So then once you get to that stage where it's fine, if I forget my toothbrush, I'll get another toothbrush at the airport. If I forget this, I'll get another one. Then it's okay. And so if you adopt that philosophy to everything else that you own, do you need the shorts that are in 3 different colours? Probably not. How many times are you going to wear each one? And so in our house as well, because we live in quite a small, well, a big studio flat, but a small flat. If you put a heat map on our flat and where we move around and where we are, we probably use the whole space. Whereas if you, like, I know people who live in massive houses, but they only use that one room once a year.
Yeah.
And so if you put a heat map on ours, it'd be fine. And it's the same with your clothes. Like, which ones do you actually wear? The ones that you don't wear, why do you even have them? What's the point?
Yeah. And do you know what? I've never heard that articulated in that way before, of everything that you own is a symbol of some kind of fear. Like, honestly, I'm still just going through my whole, like, everything in my house thinking, wow, that's really,
a lot of
it's
things
a really interesting way of thinking
fill
about it.
Lofts and fill attics and garages are there just in case. Like, oh no, I need a tree trimmer.
Yeah. Or even that fill front rooms and stuff like
that.
And so your space doing the heat map around the flat, like, that's also like choosing that flat as opposed to you know, you could afford to, like, have a bigger house or a bigger place, but it's like it's choose somewhere that's more.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, on the day that we went to go look at our flat, we saw a studio flat and we saw a 1-bedroom flat, and they weren't that different in price, but the 1-bedroom flat just felt like, well, we don't need all the space.
Yeah,
it's just a bit too big for what we actually need. And having a studio flat as well, you use the city as your living room. Yeah, rather than spending all your time in it.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody in talking about property thing, it's just too big for what we actually need. It was quite remarkable.
It was just kind of so much space, but we don't have enough stuff to put in the space. And also we have used the space fairly innovatively.
Yeah.
So when you think of studio flat, you think, ooh, so your bed's right next to your kitchen, and you know, you've got to live in the same room as your bed, but our bed does fold away.
Yeah,
right.
So it's a Murphy bed that comes down from the wall.
Yeah, so we have used it in a way that once the bed is away, it does feel like a living room. So I think you do need a bit of space just to exist. So it doesn't feel claustrophobic in any way. But it's worth adding that.
Yeah, we checked out quite a few. There are a group of guys called the Minimalists who talk about designing studio flats like that. And so we took a few ideas from that, with the Murphy bed that comes down from the wall. And then we've also got a table that normally it sits 2 people around it, but you can just extend it to 8 people. So we could have an 8-person dinner party in our flat with all the fold-up chairs and things.
And then if you run out of something while you're having dinner, you could just reach over to the fridge from your seat. Something like that.
But then everything that you need in the table exists within the table. It's not, you don't have to store anything anywhere.
Wow. I heard someone the other day told me that they had a friend who, in their kitchen, there was the oven,
there was the fridge, and then there were two dishwashers. And basically, one is dirty, and the other is clean. And they have no cupboards for, like, it was just, that's fun, right? Okay. Like,
oh, they don't have cupboards, they
just,
everything's
in. No, so you just turn one dishwasher on, and then it cleans all the stuff. And then, meanwhile, the other one is where you're storing everything that's already clean, and then it just literally...
That's cool.
One's on, one's not.
So you never empty or load the dishwasher?
You know, because just... you just put things back in the dishwasher.
Oh, I like that.
That's cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure our flat has a kitchen that is very small, and we know that we can fit a half-size dishwasher in it. I don't think we're going to be able to fit two full-size dishwashers.
Yeah, if we do, there might be a compromise.
It's a very good idea, though.
That's really cool. I like it.
So the minimalism thing, like, in terms of getting to it, so did you find that you were there things that you were throwing away or selling or getting rid of that were a challenge or that were a wrench or anything like that?
I've never missed anything. Mm. Never once actually thought.
But that's different from at the time not being reluctant to get rid of something or not wanting to get rid of something. Was there anything that you were just like, oh, I don't know if I could?
Yeah, a few things. So there's a few different techniques that various people have tried. So one thing that I don't actually know anyone who's done, but I've heard about it, is that you could put everything in your wardrobe so that the hangers are a certain way around. Yeah. And then as you wear it, when you put it back, turn the hanger the other way around and then revisit in a couple of months and you'll see all the things you haven't worn.
And it's the classic 80-20 rule thing, right? Probably about 20% of your wardrobe you wear 80% of the time.
Yeah. But there's also, there's a lady called Marie Kondo whose nickname is KonMari, the life-changing magic of tidying up.
Yeah.
And the way she talks about storing stuff as well really works well because you don't store things horizontally. So the idea is that nothing's ever on the bottom because once it's on the bottom, it's forgotten, it's not seen, you don't really use it. You store everything so you can see everything you own all in one go.
And you guys do that with all like your clothes and
everything else.
Taught other people how to do it as well.
Right. I was travelling last year and I came back and Shaz, my wife, had rearranged all of her wardrobe and all of mine in that way.
Yes.
But it takes me so long to do that. I just chuck it all in, to be honest.
Yeah, I think you have to adopt the whole mindset. I think it's easy for someone to tell you what you should be doing, but it
looked pretty for about a week.
You need to be a bit committed to it.
I think it's quite extreme, isn't it? It feels a bit crazy because her whole philosophy is that you pick an item up, you touch it, you feel it, and if it doesn't spark joy, then it has no place in your life at all, and that's when it should be thanked for its use and then sent off. So thank you very much for this event that I wore you at. Right, see you later.
Yeah, and there's definitely a thing in, I mean, like, I like that whole philosophy in the sense of it's starting to counteract a lot of the consumerist propaganda that you hear all the time, which is basically, and coming back to your thing about fear, you know, so many people want to acquire status because it's a sort of fear of insecurity about who they are and who they should be and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I try and steer clear of advertising and status symbols and all those kind of things. So I like that mindset from that point of view. Another part of me, though, just feels quite sad that someone could have been so wasteful in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's like, there are, you know, you zoom out and you look at the world from that sort of much bigger level, and you think, how many people are sat there reading this article or listening to this idea of, like, all these things, they no longer bring me joy, so I'm just going to fling them down the trash or throw them away. Like, it feels like a very, I mean, maybe it's part of that same coin. It's just like a symptom of the wasteful society that we live in, right?
Absolutely. I think you're right. And where we certainly donate close to charity as opposed to actually getting rid of them, because I totally agree. But the problem was caused in the first place by buying too much.
Yeah.
And it has. Have you ever read Stuffocation?
No,
it's
read
a
that.
Fantastic book about why humans have too much stuff.
Mm.
And essentially, we got to a point in after the Industrial Revolution where we could produce so much extra stuff than we needed. Marketing was born, and we had to convince everyone that you needed more stuff.
Yeah.
And so we started accumulating stuff that we didn't really need. And so people have ended up with, and that's why people have got garages full of stuff, lofts full of stuff. And it's because we've been marketed so effectively to that we've been told we need all this stuff to exist. And of course, marketing 101 is you have to first create a need. Do you have wrinkles around your eyes? You must have wrinkles around your eyes if you're, you know, over 40. You must therefore need this cream. And that's marketing 101. And everyone does it, which is why we have so much stuff. So if people can not buy stuff in the first place, then hopefully there isn't that waste. But you're absolutely right, there is two sides to it.
So there's nothing that you miss in terms of being able to pack all your stuff into a car?
No, not at all. not at all.
And is there any, are there ever times where you go around to a friend's house and they've got a house full of stuff and you go, oh, this is beautiful, this is nice?
No, we're like, oh, but we teach our friends, we give buy our friends stuffification books. So please,
it just sits
out
in a pile of all their other books.
I think yeah, there's an element of, I certainly can appreciate nice things and nice clothes and nice objects and, you know, nice big houses and flats, and I think they're great. I think they're nice things, places to visit, and it's nice to go and have a holiday in a nice villa that's got more space, but ultimately the way you want to live your life, I think for us the priority is being streamlined, and there's always going to be pros and cons, and the perfect lifestyle is represented by so many different things for different people, but for us it's the essentialism stuff.
Because we were talking on the train as well about social media and about how our kind of generation
we're the millennials and then the guys who are just a bit younger than us are Generation Z.
So we're growing up where all our friends, like, it's just kind of common that you know everyone's achievements because we're all on social media, everyone's talking about everything, congratulating each other, and so there's so many of our friends doing really cool stuff, and some of them you're like, oh yeah, I'd really like to do that as well, but then some of them it's more like, I'm really really happy for that person, but that's not something I see myself as wanting to achieve. So then I think there's an important,
and such as, is that again down the route of sort of possessions, well, and stuff, or is that down the route of careers,
just anything, just because I think we're quite kind of set in our idea of what success means to us, and obviously success means so many different things to different people, and that's a good thing, but then with social media you run the risk of wanting to have all the success of that everyone's having all at the same time, so being able to distinguish what's what you want and what's what you don't want as
well, people do not share the tough times in their life, the days that they're, well, some people do, but generally people share achievements and great things they're doing, and it's very easy to sit on social media, and if you've got 500 friends on Facebook you are seeing several pretty good achievements every single day, and you think, wow, everyone else is having such a great time, they're doing such amazing things, and then, you know, some of your friends will be getting married, or they'll have the keys to their first flat, or they'll have a new BMW, or they say, I've just got this promotion, I've just got this raise, and I think it's very easy to let other people's idea of success influence yours. And if you're being dragged along by, oh, they've got a BMW, I need a BMW, you're letting other people's definitions guide what you're doing, and I think that's why it's important to do the exercises where you're looking at, what do I want to do more of, what do I want to do less of, and see what happiness actually means to you.
If I was to say to you that someone would offer you big money to buy your business, so you'd have a load of money, but then a caveat of that is there's a clause in that contract which means you can't set up another business, would you sell?
Why can't I set up another business? Because I have to work in...
I'm just interested by the dynamic of, is one of the important things for you to you know, to have autonomy and to be an entrepreneur and work on your own thing, you know, and so actually that supports your lifestyle, versus money, I guess, could support your lifestyle, but it also sounds like it's not a driver for you in terms of BMWs and things.
Well, so we've had offers for people to buy our business. We've both been offered pretty, like, very, very well paid jobs, actually, over the past couple of years. But it's not, the autonomy is so important. And whilst we both like, I guess money's important because it facilitates lifestyle and it facilitates everything that we want to do. But I think I find it very, very hard to be on someone else's terms.
I agree. I think the idea of not having to do anything really appeals, and you know, you can think it's going to be great, but I'd be incredibly surprised if I could sit down for 2 weeks, even a week, and not do anything productive, and not get really bored and want to do something and change things, because everything we've started is because of a passion or because of a drive to change something for the better. And it's not fun, is it? I mean, it's fulfillment, isn't it? It's really, I think money, we had a friend this week say, money's easy, fulfillment is hard. And money makes the world go around, money facilitates a lot of things, and it's free, and it's freedom, but it's not, money for money's sake's not the goal, is it? It's doing something that means to you. I don't think people ever get to old age and say, wow, thank you know, I'm so glad that I made all that money. They're not going to say that. It's the relationships they had. It's the great times they had.
Completely. And I think money is also only freedom with the right mindset as well.
Yeah.
And I think often people's mindset around money becomes so negative in so many different ways that it could, no matter how much money you had, you'd never be free, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I think with... I feel quite lucky at the moment that with JC Social Media and with Clever Tykes and with the various little projects we do, like, I feel quite a big sense of fulfillment, and I really genuinely love doing all of them. But if I wasn't happy for like even a second, it'd be like, right, let's do something else, because there's no point just not being happy.
And did you have time? So you say, if I wasn't happy for a second, there must have been seconds in 5 years of running a business, because I know, Jodie, I've set up a business as well. Yeah. So there'll be times where it's low.
Yeah, but...
So what gets you through those times if you're also then saying, hey, you know, if I wasn't happy for a second, I'd move this thing up?
So a few things. One thing I really like is that I'll go off on a tangent and I'll come back.
Okay.
So we use an accountancy software called Xero.
Yeah, I use it too.
Okay, so when you log into Xero, on the bottom right hand corner, it's got, how are you feeling with Xero today? It's got a happy face, a neutral face, and a sad face. I do that every day. How are you feeling with your life today? Happy face, neutral face, sad face. And overall, is it a happy face? Because if you have too many sad faces, that's where it's like, right, what do I need to do to change this? I think it's just being self-aware.
Yeah.
And being... and also taking time out of each day to like say five things that you're grateful for, because you know, don't you, if you know, when there's always going to be hard times and there's always going to be things that are a bit of a struggle, but as long as it's all aligned with your overall value and your overall purpose, then fine. That's part of the journey. But if it's really like, right, this is rubbish and I can't see a way out, then that's when it needs to go.
And I guess like a feeling of some of those difficult times being temporary, or being, this is a thing until this changes, is one thing. But when it's like, oh, actually, I'm just not enjoying it, I'm not feeling it day to day.
Yeah.
That's maybe a different thing. And it's kind of knowing the difference between those two things, maybe.
And there are probably so many cheesy phrases on Instagram, like the best for you comes after the hardest climb, and loads of one like that. But it's sort of true.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're definitely right. It's the transient mood fluctuations that you need to kind of ignore, and it is that base level. Well, what have we achieved? What are we achieving? What does our life actually look like? Is it good or bad? But I certainly think that as entrepreneurs, you indoctrinate yourself to be positive.
Yeah.
And actually, because if you're not going to be the driving force behind your business, if you don't think it's going to be great, it's not going to be great. It's going to fail. So whether you are actually having a great time or not, or whether you think your business is going to succeed or not, you have to tell yourself that it is. And I think you tell yourself that for so long that is just your default setting. You are just an optimist, and you have to be. So stripping it back to the bare bones, I mean, there probably have been times when you look at it and you think, wow, this isn't going well. Wow, this, you know, you've got a lot of work to do here, and things aren't looking so great. But you cannot for a second think that. You just cannot. You cannot even let it into your brain. You have to say, everything's going well, I'm going to succeed.
I guess the caveat to that being, as long as, you know, if you spend 2 years, like, you can have too much optimism in a business, right? So you can get to a point where it's like, I have to do everything to make this work, and yet you're trying to create chocolate teapots or something that just isn't the right thing, and then optimism is a misplaced thing, right?
Absolutely. And you can see that time and time again on Dragon's Den, don't you? You see guys going in there and they say, how much money have you put into this? And there's like, well, I've put about
200,000.
Yeah. Stop. please stop what you're doing. Go back to the day job. And that's just a perfect example of people who have taken that to the extreme, and there's no external source of someone saying, I think this isn't going to work. And that's, of course, why it's so important to have people like mentors in your life, mentors, coaches. I mean, Jodie and I are quite lucky to have each other in a sense, because someone can have a mind of reason, or coming from a slightly different angle at least. But having a mentor hopefully avoids that kind of scenario.
Yeah. And you have like external mentors as well. Like it just feels really remarkable how like you guys have such a sort of aligned sort of sense of mission, purpose, lifestyle, all this kind of stuff. But like, I mean, do you have people outside of...
Yeah, we both have mentors. We both have separate mentors.
Yeah.
Who we'll go and have various different chats with. I quite like coaching as well. So the idea that you don't go to someone for advice, you go to someone so that they can ask you loads of questions and grill you about stuff so that you get to the answer yourself.
And the mentor thing, is that like a formal thing that you have set up? Like, how's it work?
I have maybe one session every month or every 6 weeks, and I guess you do about the same.
Yeah, I my kind of form of mentoring is more conversations to people who are like-minded.
Yeah.
And people who you know see things well and think about things and ask the right questions. And I wouldn't necessarily, there's a kind of mentor-mentee relationship, but you spend enough time with enough people talking about the problems, you'll get to solutions, and you'll keep moving forward, which is ultimately all you're trying to do is make the right next step.
And have you ever had things come up in those sort of sessions where
you've identified something that you really want to do that you think maybe the other person doesn't really want to do, or like things where you've not been so aligned, and you know, does that come up when you're not with each other, and then do you have to sort of bring that back to the couple and to each other sort of thing?
I think I'm more for one to entertain ideas, which in hindsight some of them would have certainly sidetracked us.
I hope the microphone picked up Jodie sort of sniggering a bit.
It's because I don't know which route you're going down here, but sometimes Ben will be like, hey, I've got this really good idea, and I'll be like, no, I can't handle any more ideas, we need to focus on these two businesses, stop coming to me.
So you have to give an example of one of those.
I don't know, I mean, often they're ideas related to what we are currently doing, and it is a sidetrack to the business's goal, but other times it is just a completely brand new random idea. Let's do this.
There are loads. We've got a book, so what we've started to do is there's a notebook which in the back it says parked ideas, and they're ideas that usually Ben has where we're like, right, we're not going to do this right now because it will detract from what we're doing. We're so focused on the two things that we're doing that we can't add other things in, and that's where we'll write a list of them, but they're quite...
Oh yeah, no, we can mention that. Yeah, well, I just had an idea, so I don't know if that would have picked that up, but
yeah, that might already be on the.
So I just thought, kind of had this idea, and I thought, wow, it would be really great to have the Meaty Muffin Company and have muffins with meaty things in them, because you can have, you know, quite sweet muffins, but you can have savoury muffins. I thought, I even wanted to go for a meaty
muffin. With like beef in and stuff.
Yeah,
like.
With a bit
bacon.
Like a roast dinner muffin. I thought that'd be a really good idea, but again, it's parked. And it actually, very, very briefly, one of the guys that I speak to a lot came up with this idea of causal and effectual thinking. And the causal thinking is when you wake up with an amazing great idea and then you make things work around it. So a perfect example of that was the Clever Textbooks. We thought, wow, this is a great idea. But then you start having to learn how to write a book, and you have to learn how to publish a book, and you have to learn how the printing process works,
and the education system.
Then you have to learn from scratch the education system. You have to build relationships with people. And that's not a great way to start a business, because at the end of the day, if someone says to you, are you the best person to start this business? The answer is probably no.
Yeah.
I might be now because I've done all that learning process. But really, you need to think effectually, and you look at yourselves and you think, what are my skill sets? Or what is the group skill sets? Who do we know network-wise? What would an exit strategy look like potentially? And you build an idea that way. And that's more aligned with the projects that we've started more recently, where you actually think, as a group of four or five people, are you the best people to do this? The answer is probably yes. It's so uniquely entwined around us that we can actually make this work.
And so those are the ones that you focus on, where there's, it almost feels like there's less friction, more momentum and traction behind
definitely.
It.
Yeah,
definitely. Because it overcomes so many barriers. Because when we were first starting Clever Tags and we made a teacher's guide to go alongside the books, Ben researched about 10 years of Ofsted papers just to work out how we could best fit it all into the existing curriculum. And so someone who was already in that market would already know, well, this will work, that won't work. Yeah. And you'd save like days and days of work. So yeah, the projects that we focus on more now are things that we already know the industry of.
Yeah, and they're certainly more collaborative. We work with other people who have got slightly different skills and interests, and that helps with the management of work, because we can do the stuff that we're really great at. They can do the stuff that they're really great at. And before long, you've actually got a product that's quite good. But because you're such specialists, you produce things very, very quickly, and it doesn't take the, you know, however long it would take to create the Meaty Muffin Company.
Wow.
If anyone listening does want to start the Meaty Muffin Company, and let us know.
So, do they cut you in on the deal? Are they business partners, or are they having the idea for free?
We'll just have a couple of muffins every now and again.
Send you some muffins in the post. It reminds me of in Portland in the US, there's what's this, like a donut company called I can't remember the name of it now. Someone will write in. But there's like a donut company where they basically make donuts out of like breakfast cereals and like all this kind of weird, and you can get bacon in the donuts and all that sort of
That's
thing.
Cool.
And people get on the plane at Portland Airport with these pink boxes from the donut company because they're visiting someone else in the US, and it's like, oh, bring me some donuts. It's like the thing to do in Portland. So just reminding me of that. I've loved this conversation. I've loved just how focused you guys are, like just really inspiring, like the work that you're doing. So I'd just love to finish by talking about goal setting, and how do you set them, when do you set them, and what have you found that has worked for you around how you set and achieve those goals?
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that we we certainly realised is that when we were making those lists of what do we want to do more of, start doing, those kind of things, we realised that one of the biggest blockers was just booking them. And we got these goals and we actually thought, well, these are goals. Well, what are the barriers to the goals? And we realised the barriers were just us. Mm. And we had to just get out of the way of ourselves and actually book these things in. So whether it was, you know, going to certain restaurants, booking these trips in, and that just getting things booked and in the diary, it means you've got to reach it. You've got to reach those goals.
So you said the barrier was you. Was the barrier a lot around? So when you decide to go and live in Toronto for a couple of months and work there or whatever, and was the barrier in terms of you about sort of abundance mentality and like, yes, I give myself permission to do that, or was it just like more practical?
It was more like it feeling like the right time,
right?
Because okay. It never quite feels like the right time. So it's like, oh, we'll book it then. Oh, we'll book it then. Oh, we'll book it next week because we need to sort something out first. But then we found that if you just book it, then you sort everything else out.
Then everything else falls around it rather than waiting for the perfect moment to do
definitely.
Things.
Yeah. It's like that thing
everyone says, like, there's never a perfect time to have kids.
That's
right? Which is
that's
very
it.
True. You just have to adjust the rest of your life at that moment. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So that was certainly one of the ways that we managed to quickly achieve a lot of our goals. But with where you know where we're heading, I mean, we have really worked on our lifestyle to the point that we really enjoy it. We have kind of got a flat exactly where we need it to be, that we can walk to our gym, we can walk to work, and we can go and remote work, you know, anywhere in the world for a month. So it's not necessarily that we're trying to change anything at the moment. So it's great to say we've achieved all our goals, but we're not certainly not quite there. But we're very close to what we want to do.
Each year there's like a kind of, you know, that amazing time in the middle of Christmas and New Year when it's just like actual guilt-free holiday.
Yeah.
So there's usually when we kind of go to a coffee shop or something and then write down like, what have we achieved this year? What do we want to achieve next year? And so I've got that going back to 2011, I think, of every year, like, what was the goal? Did we reach it? What is it next year? And then all those in a row. Because that's quite cool, like, just at the end of the year, being like, right, what's next year? What's next year got to hold?
You've just made me realise that, because I do something very similar around that time of year, but I never look back.
Okay.
And so I never give myself that sort of, yes, I achieved that, or, I didn't, and then why?
Yeah.
And I don't
and
do the
why is important,
you know?
Because...
And I do the reflection on a weekly basis, but I don't do it on that bigger sort of yearly basis. That's interesting.
And the why is really important, because in January you might say you want to do a certain thing, and then at the end it's like, well, actually I didn't even want to do that anymore, so I haven't achieved it, but it's fine because my priorities have changed. And then something I did the other day, after I read a book called You Are the Placebo, and it's all about when you say things or think things and your mind can't distinguish between it actually happening and you saying it about something that's actually happened, or about you saying it about something that hasn't happened. So I wrote my bio as in my kind of elevator pitch for when I'm 30, so two and a half years time. It was, hello, I'm Jodie Cook, this is my 30th birthday, I am, and it was the kind of how I want to describe myself then, based on certain things kind of achieved by then. And then you got that feeling in your head, and then it's like, ah, this is so close, this could actually happen.
Yeah.
And that helps align all the
goals.
What did
it say?
Oh, I couldn't possibly tell you all the stuff. It's quite big though, like, it's quite big, it's quite out there, as in what I want to have achieved with all the different projects, but... It's more, it's not necessarily even for publication. It's more like just to revisit every now and again.
Yeah. Why would you not publish it? Why would you not share it?
Don't know. I guess it's just not for that purpose.
It probably sounds really egotistical.
Yeah, it probably does.
And when you haven't achieved it yet. I mean, because of course there's going to be goals with the business side. There's certainly the goals of getting the national package with Clever Types. But sometimes it's quite dangerous to even put that on paper, because... Goals and targets are the ones that are written down are the ones that you want to achieve, and sometimes you may not even go about achieving them in the right way. And what I mean by that is that I think if we can all focus, especially business people who are working on self-improvement, if we actually improve ourselves as managers, being more productive, being more mindful, as a result of that, as a byproduct of that, we will be better achievers in our businesses. And I was talking to Jodie recently about this as well. There's a lot of entrepreneurs say, you know, I'm a great entrepreneur because I'm never satisfied, and they're always driven to do more. But if you're never satisfied, are you ever happy? Are you just driving to do more to make more money? So really, you have to learn to be happy with the existing situation, but not so happy that you don't work. So being happy and then improving oneself by various means, reading a lot of, you know, self-improvement books, that should help achieve your business goal without actually writing down your business goals in terms of, you know, in monetary terms for, or whatever.
Yeah, there's something really interesting in the dynamic of that, of so happiness coming from gratitude and a contentment with where you're at, but then the goal is the thing that creates the tension to give you the motivation. Because if you didn't have tension, then there's no reason to, I guess, to get up in the morning. And
absolutely,
I think on the lines of it not necessarily being for publication as well, it's sort of to do with something I read. There's a guy called Derek Sivers who wrote, the guy who started CD Baby and wrote Anything You Want, and it's like a really nice version of starting a business just with no rules. And he works on the premise that somewhere there's someone on a beach, there's a man on a beach selling fish, and that's a business. So if he can do it that simply, you can do it that simply. And he talks about your clients don't care about your growth aspirations. They don't care about how big you want your business to be. They care that you're looking after them right now, and that's it. And he was like, but the stupid thing is you focus on that and that will get you to reach your goals as well. So I guess if we've got goals about getting Jay's social media to be, I don't know, X number of people really big, then it actually takes away from the thing that we're really focusing on, which is just making clients happy, delighting people.
Yeah, right, okay, yeah. Whereas if the focus is just client, focus in that way, then all the good stuff will follow, right? And you'll get to that point.
Yeah.
What I thought you were going to say there was, if we're focused on the business in that sense, the business will sort of facilitate your personal growth and a lot of those other things.
I think it can do. I mean, I think on the other side of it as well, though, if you don't achieve those goals, you can often see yourself as a failure. And yet you can have worked really, really well. It can have been a fantastic year, but you may not have achieved your goals. And there can be a number of external factors that may be reason. You can't be an entrepreneur and bring up external factors because, you know, it rests on you. The buck stops at you. You can't do that. It's making excuses for yourself. But once you've got a monetary value there, right, we need to reach a turnover of X, and you actually only reach X minus 5. How does that go down as a success? Does it go down as a failure? So there's definitely pros and cons to putting monetary values on things or certain goals.
Yeah. One of our goals last year was to meet the Queen. But then we got invited to the Queen's Garden
just
Party.
Just like for the crack?
I don't know, it was just there. It was just on the ground.
Just a fun thing, yeah.
And then we got invited to the Queen's Garden Party last year, and we found out pretty early on that you pretty much have to make a choice. It's either you wait in line and you maybe meet the Queen, or you eat a lot of food.
Or you go and actually have fun and talk to all the interesting people there.
And the food was incredible.
Yeah.
I don't know if we would have met the Queen anyway. We saw her. We sang the national anthem with her.
And so because that was a goal to meet the Queen, I'm interested why you didn't just go, well, that was my focus, I'm just going to stand in the queue. Like, what was that decision about?
I don't know. Obviously, I don't know. I would still like to meet the Queen.
Priorities change, don't they? When you're there and, you know, you can see all the teas and the posh scones, you think, actually, the scone looks really tasty.
So that's it for Ben and Jodie. I hope you enjoyed that one. It was really fun hanging out with them, and thanks again to Ben and Jodie for making the trip down from Birmingham. And Ben's interested in coming to some Villa games with me this year, so at least we can console each other, at least, I guess. Although maybe it'll be good. Maybe not being in the Premier League this season. It's going to be different. That's what I keep saying. It's going to be different, whatever it turns out to be. If you want to find out more about what they do, I'll put all the links to this in the show notes, because there's lots of stuff I could spell out and I just won't. But it's all at getbeyondbusy.com. You'll find all the links there. JCSocialMedia.com, CleverTykes.com. And then on Twitter, Jodie is at CookieWorlds and Ben is at BenCookBSC. So do check them out. I'm sure they'd love to connect. And also, if you're interested in getting some help with your business's social media, whether that's buying a really reasonably priced ebook, or whether it's getting some training from JC Social Media, or whether it's actually just outsourcing the entire thing and letting them handle it, they're really switched on people and they will definitely do a great job for you. So go and check out jcsocialmedia.com. Thanks also to Mark Sedman from Bloomsbury Digital, and thanks all of you for listening. Just getting some really nice comments in at the moment, and you know, just really nice feedback on the show, so really thanks to all of you for just being engaged in this and being part of this project. If you haven't subscribed, please do. That really helps. And also just tell your friends and just spread the word. We're going to do another episode in 2 weeks' time, then take a short break and come back with series two. But yeah, just really loving doing this so far and really loving the connections that I'm making with you guys as part of the audience on this as well. So drop me a line, graham@thinkproductive.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you. And if you haven't checked out my book, it's called How to Be a Productivity Ninja. And my business is thinkproductive.com and thinkproductive.co.uk in the UK. So as I say, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with episode 10 of Beyond Busy. And until then, thanks for listening. Take care. Goodbye.